Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The big three suck wind, so does the economy and power coming and going in Washington this week. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi says no plan for viability, no bailout for Detroit.
Until we can see a plan where the auto industry is held accountable, a plan for viability on how they go into the future, until we see the plan, until they show us the plan, we cannot show them the money.
Markets tremble as Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says he's doing the best he can.
There was no playbook for responding to a once or twice in a 100-year event.
And Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, now a convicted felon, loses his re-election bid and won't look back.
I don't have any rear-view mirror. I look only forward, and I still see the day when I can remove the cloud that currently surrounds me.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you think about Obama's cabinet picks so far? The big three begging? Wall Street? The Iraq deal? Somali pirates? Joining us today from New York is Diane Brady, senior editor for Business Week magazine. Diane, great to have you with us. Thanks for being
here. Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
With us from Washington, Joe Williams, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Joe, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Joe, and Diane.
Oh, my goodness. There is so much on the table here. I don't know where to dive in. But, Diane, let's start with the big three in Washington. We heard Nancy Pelosi there saying, hey, no plan, no money. No plan for viability, no money. After all these years, they've got a plan for viability up their sleeve that we don't know about, Diane? Is that possible?
Well, I think the viability is give us the money. I think it's a little bit of passing the buck, obviously. You can't strike a deal and somebody has to take the blame. But the reality is that there is no real plan insofar as they're just kind of trying to survive at this point. And in the absence of bankruptcy, which is really what a lot of people we're talking to say is the main option for GM and Chrysler, it's very difficult for them to say how exactly they're going to take $25, even $50 billion and suddenly radically turn the industry around.
Joe, I want to ask you how all this feels in Washington as they look on these guys arriving in their private jets, but let's listen to a little bit of the testimony. Here's GM CEO Rick Wagoner painting a grim picture before the Senate Banking Committee of what would happen if the big three were allowed to fail.
3 million jobs lost within the first year, personal income reduced by $150 billion, government tax loss of more than $156 billion over 3 years, not to mention the huge blow to consumer and business confidence.
Well, Congress wasn't having any of it, really. In House hearings on Wednesday, Democratic Congressman Gary Ackerman of New York mocked the three automaker CEOs who testified, mocked them for using corporate jets to travel to D.C. to argue for a bailout.
There's a delicious irony in seeing private luxury jets flying in to Washington, D.C., and people coming off of them with tin cups in their hand, saying that they're going to be trimming down and streamlining their businesses. It's almost like seeing a guy show up at the soup kitchen in high hat and tuxedo.
Didn't look good, and here's Texas Republican Jeb Hanseling of asking the CEOs whether it would be safe to bail them out.
How do I know that you will not become the next AIG? $25 billion now, $25 billion next month, $25 billion the month after that.
Joe, it's easy to mock these guys. On the other hand, it's a lot of people's jobs and a big chunk of American industry on the line here at the same time. What do you feel after all the posturing? Is there still the possibility of a bailout here, Joe, or is it just not going to happen?
Well, there's still a strong possibility. I mean, Speaker Pelosi was holding out some kind of measure, and they came close to striking an accord probably about 24 hours ago, but nothing happened. And increasingly, there's pessimism, and there's increasingly worry that something needs to get done. And also increasingly, a nation turns its weary eyes to the president-elect, and a lot of people have been talking about, well, if Congress is not going to do a deal and we've got a lame duck president who's not willing to put his prestige on the line, and Republicans who are still smarting from a big defeat not 3 weeks ago, somebody's got to do something, and the somebody is more and more looking like it's going to be Barack Obama. There's a lot of chatter here lately about how soon he needs to pick someone for his Treasury Secretary and somebody to take over this plan and figure out what to do. We've got jobs at stake. The big four say they're going under. It's getting more and more urgent, and they're saying, okay, President-elect Obama, congratulations. Welcome to Washington. How about that money? Who's going to be handling it? And pick somebody to get us out of this mess.
Diane, pull the curtain back a little bit for us here. Whether it's with the big automakers or the bigger picture of American finance and Wall Street this week, I mean, everything just seemed to be trembling, if not tumbling. And this issue of a kind of not enough happening in the interim between these presidents, the election and the inauguration, seemed very much on people's minds.
I think so. I mean, I think certainly the choice of a Treasury Secretary is very important. But if I were Barack Obama, I don't think I'd be wanting to step into the fray at this point and deal with the existing mess. I think I would probably want to wait and have a fresh slate. He can be behind the scenes. But this is a very tumultuous transition with two parties that are on completely opposite sides. So I don't blame him for that. But in terms of the overall economy, there's no question that there's intense fear right now. You see it with the retailers. Many of them are on the precipice of bankruptcy at this point with their stock prices falling. The big three, I think there is this visceral almost anger against them that's going to really prevent a meaningful bailout. Obama has said he's not going to let them fail. So there's no question. There's just not he's going to do something. The question is whether it's going to be too late by the time he gets there.
Says but, he won't let them fail, but of course what we read, they could be bankrupt by the time he's inaugurated. GM
they
anyway.
Could. GM could, and I think all the talks between GM and Chrysler are happening for a reason. Ford has this strained two-tiered family-owned structure. I think you almost want to leave them aside, but there's no question GM's running out of money. Chrysler's in a very bad place, and the industry just cannot sustain three automakers with this cost structure. People understand that there has to be radical transformation. It's not a question of giving them money to get them over the hump. This has been an issue for a generation now, and it's just come to a crisis at this point.
Obama's been talking about it. Here he was earlier this week on 60 Minutes.
For the auto industry to completely collapse would be a disaster in this kind of environment, not just for individual families, but the repercussions across the economy would be dire. So it's my belief that we need to provide assistance to the auto industry. But I think that it can't be a blank check.
Jack, what do you see here? While he moves, pretty vigorously to putting a cabinet together and the calendar moves towards January, General Motors may be moving toward bankruptcy.
Yes, and we have a Treasury Secretary and an administration that seems becalmed. Secretary Paulson said the other day, he's not going to spend about half of that $700 billion. After all, he told National Public Radio, things look pretty good for the banking system. Today we read, of course, the banks are in terrible shape, and there's a renewal of the panic. Barney Frank, the chairman of one of the House committees, told him he had the authority, according to Congress, to aid people who have mortgages, to actually give money to people at the root of the crisis. He said, I don't have the authority to do that. They told him he had authority to take $25 billion out of that $700 million and give it to the auto companies. Don't have authority to do that. This man is writing a chapter here that is, it may turn out to be one of the, tragedies in this, really unfortunate aspects of this whole unfolding tragedy, that we have a man so limited in his purview and outlook as Treasury Secretary and a president so detached that they can't step up to the plate and recognize that this economy needs massive stimulus right now, or we are heading into a terrible spiral next year.
Joe Williams, how do you read that? Hank Paulson is not a guy who's been, for most of his life, described as limited. Quite the contrary, though these are different circumstances. President Bush kind of invisible. Are we becalmed? Is this just the danger of the handoff gap? Is there I mean, could we have a worse intersection of this gear changing and the demands of the economy?
Well, it looks to me like President Bush had, you know, all his comments to the contrary about sprinting to the finish probably isn't even on the track at this point. There's not a lot of relevance coming out of the White House. There's not a lot of direction either. You don't you can't remember the last time you've seen President Bush speak vigorously on the economy, or at least seem as though he's in a take charge position. And it almost seems like everyone is looking to kick the can down the road to January 20th, but there's a real sense of urgency here. And Secretary Paulson, it's hard to make of what he describes as his lack of power, despite vigorous efforts by Chairman Frank to get him to invest in that power, to do something right now. And you've got sort of a weird confluence of events where you have a Republican Party that's not willing to step to the plate because they feel they got burned in the bailout package right before the election. The Democrats are sort of hoping to make some moves, but really can't do so without a strong direction. They don't want to get pinned with this either. And you have a president who's basically looking more and more like he is checked out. There's not really a whole lot of vigorous enthusiasm or direction coming from the White House these days.
But Hank Paulson's old buddies, Diane, must be shouting down the line from Wall Street at him loudly. I mean, he knows the straits the market in, the straits the banks are in. This is not invisible to him.
No, and one of the things that I found intriguing is this kind of serial apocalyptic sense that you get out of both Wall Street, Washington, Paulson. I mean, you recall within hours we were supposed to be getting these toxic assets off the books of the banks. This was how the whole crisis started. We needed to get this stuff out of the system. That's one of the reasons Citigroup is imploding. Now there's a sense that nothing's going to happen on that front. So I think we don't have any perspective at this point. What about the mortgages and individuals? What about the stimulus? All of this panic, we just keep getting new panic every week, and I think people just don't know what to do, and the paralysis is set in. That, to me, is Paulson.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama's emerging cabinet, the big three, go begging markets, hit new lows. We're joined by Diane Brady, senior editor at Businessweek magazine, Joe Williams, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's take a call from Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Renee. Renee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a question regarding the failure of the big three. Nancy Pelosi had mentioned the time of war, and admittedly, I hadn't even thought about that. What are the implications of letting the auto industry fail on our war on terror and future wars?
Let us pick it up. Joe Williams, is there much talk about that from the Pentagon or congressmen in this war, in future wars? What about tanks and Hummers and, you know, all the vehicles that come out of American industry or have? Can you have national security without a vigorous American-owned transportation industry?
Well, that depends largely on who you ask. I mean, the first point is that the wars that we're fighting are much different than the traditional wars that we fought in World War II, World War I, where you had American industry gearing up to provide the material that the troops would need to fight the battles. These wars are almost subcontracted to a degree where you don't have that big push to put people to work, to employ them in factories, to make the stuff that the troops need to carry out these missions.
Yeah, but Joe, they still have to drive around. I mean, are they going to do that in Toyota RAV4s down the road?
Doubtful that they'll do that, but certainly a lot of it has been subcontracted. We had a lot of these issues come up when there was discussion about the troops being short of body armor, of up-armored Humvees. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about people, well, why can't GM gear up to do this right away like we did in World War II? The short answer is it's complicated. The bigger picture is that a lot of this stuff is subcontracted out. A lot of the components that go into a Hummer aren't necessarily made in the United States or aren't necessarily made in the same plant where the Hummer is assembled. You've got to bring stuff in, you've got to import this, you've got to assemble that. And it looks like those days are gone to a large degree. And on a national security front, high unemployment is definitely a national security issue if you talk to most economists, because you have idle people on the streets, and it can sow a sort of atmosphere that the government really doesn't want to try to have to deal with at a time when it's dealing with other things, loss of life and complex actions on foreign shores.
Of course, it's complicated to think about national security in a time of globalization, and still, you can kind of hear Renee's question there about what if we someday needed a whole bunch of Jeeps or whatever it might be. Let's go to Robin in Paulett, Vermont. Robin, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. You're my lifeline here in Vermont every morning. I'm happy to hear what's going on out in the world.
Great.
I want to make a point about Ms. Pelosi. I do want to see the car companies survive in some form, but I also agree with her about the money and show the plan. I, for years, 20 years, have been an entrepreneur, have started three companies, and every time I would go to Citibank or any of the big banks, I had to have a plan, and I had to have a good plan. And often I was not given the money by those companies. I eventually had to get private capital. And, you know, to just give someone $25 billion without a plan, I do think is ludicrous.
But, you know, they have had plans. They've been acting on plans. But you're a businesswoman then, Robin. Do you think Detroit has or could have up its sleeve a kind of magic plan that would everyone could read and say, oh, of course, why didn't we think of that before? Here's the money.
Well, it's not that. I mean, we all have a wish list, and we say, okay, if I had $1 million tomorrow, how would I run my business? These guys, if we give them $25 billion in their bank account tomorrow, they're going to have to know right away what they're going to do with it. So if they're going to know tomorrow, they might as well know today.
Let us pick it up. Diane, let me ask you, I've wondered if this demand for a plan, since who knows if they can deliver, you know, a plan, is that a kind of euphemism for heads to roll? Does she want to hear that they're going to fire XYZ?
I think so. I mean, the reality is, you know, half the market now is cars made by the Germans, the Japanese, the Koreans, because Americans prefer those cars. GM basically has a structure for a time when it commanded a much larger market share than it does now. You can't really have a plan in that environment when you've got a cost structure that just doesn't fit the market, and Americans are buying a lot fewer cars this year from everyone. So I think a plan is basically a euphemism, excuse me, to say we don't have a reason to give you the money at this point. That's what, to me, the plan is. They cannot come up with a plan. That's why they're looking at things such as a Chrysler-GM merger, because in the absence of something dramatic happening in Detroit, it's just more of the same.
What do you say, Jack?
Well, yeah, the plan. I mean, you know, Detroit would look a heck of a lot better if we didn't have this credit crunch, if people could actually get credit to buy cars.
That's true.
A year ago, this October, I think their stock was about, well, I don't know, it was 40-something. Now it's 4 or somewhere there. And J.D. Power, in their recent surveys, ranks Detroit doing much better. And in some measures now, according to Consumer Reports, Ford, at least, is on a par with the best of Toyota and Honda. The point is, and the UAW and Ford have reached a real path-breaking agreement that involves give-backs and changes in rules and the kind of, you know, 21st century where we're all in this together synergy. You know, there are a lot of things out there. And then on the future, they have got, you know, the Volt, the first plug-in car. That would be a leap over Japanese technology. These companies have got something going for them. And absent this terrible financial crisis, I think some real, you know, view of their health might be taken. It's almost as if the Congress is saying, it's forgetting, wait a minute, the main problem here is nobody's got any money or could get any credit to buy cars.
Jack, they're going to send you to the auto show pretty soon to drape yourself over the hood of a nice-looking sparkler. There's a lot on the table here. Sherdan, Iowa, George, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a Obama supporter that's really disappointed in Senator Obama's cabinet appointments because they come from the Democratic Leadership Council. You got Hillary Clinton and Tom Vilsack, who's being mentioned for Secretary of Agriculture. They were both co-chairs of the DLC last year.
The DLC, the kind of centrist third way that Bill Clinton championed.
They're big supporters of neoliberalism, of globalization, where you make a few people at the top of every economy in the world very rich, and you impoverish a whole bunch of peasants and working people at the bottom. And then, you know, the other day you were talking about, well, what are we going to, we need a new role for Bill Clinton. You need a title for him. I would suggest Godfather. and maybe call the White House the Clinton Country Club.
Okay. But you don't see the change that you worked for, George, in this emerging list.
No, absolutely not. If a real change would have been to make the priorities of the economy, to make sure that people that work for a living get a fair wage, and farmers and peasants around the world get a fair price for their products.
George, so let us pick it up. Yeah, we hear it. Let me take it to Joe Williams. Joe, this is a line of criticism that's very much alive out there right now. Compliments for what Obama's up to, but also some of his hardcore supporters saying, you know what, we don't want to go back to Clinton days.
Well, that criticism is going to get louder, I suspect, unless there are some really surprise picks or some people that speak to the left. There were a lot of people talking about how the whole Hillary Clinton drama that's been playing out is kind of a worrisome sign among those Obama supporters. But if you take a close look, his actual policy programs, his policy platforms weren't all that far out of line from Hillary Clinton. They were very similar on a lot of issues. They diverged, of course, on the war, but on other things like economic policy, they were pretty close. And the difference seemed to be that Obama was better able to brand what he wanted to do, or more able to brand his form of Democratic leadership, because he's fairly conservative. I mean, as far as the Democrats go, I mean, he's not the sort of progressive change agent that a lot of people might have envisioned, or at least it's not playing out that way. And certainly he's looking for experience, but there is a very definite tightrope that he's going to have to walk between the actual change that he seemed to indicate that he would bring to Washington, and the sort of experienced hands that he's going to need to not fail, because this is a really big time to be the president. I mean, there's a lot going on. It would be very, very easy for him to trip up over exuberance to make change when there really isn't all that much change that's going to be possible, because there's no money in the Treasury. The military is decimated. There are a lot of problems that he's walking into right off the bat. So he'll need some kind of support and some way to survive his first term, I'd say.
Jack Beatty, what do you think here? You know, a lot of gloom and doom out there right now. On the other hand, you and I were at a dinner earlier this week where Dan Shore was addressing the audience and saying, in addition to reprising Singing One More Time as Brother Can You Spare a Dime live there, he was saying he's never felt more optimistic in spite of all these daunting challenges. I was at a dinner last night where John Lewis, the Georgia congressman and civil rights hero, was speaking. And, you know, he's saying Obama's going to do what he promised. He's going to hang in, don't lose faith. But here's an Obama supporter from Iowa saying, what do you mean he's not a progressive change agent? What do you think I was working for?
Well, look what's happening. Tom Daschle has just got that big appointment at HHS. Is that what it is now?
H's out there.
Yeah, Health and Human Services. There it is.
Yes.
Now this means something. He is a navigator. He's not appointed to run that department. He's appointed to get national health insurance. That's what's on the books. The biggest expansion of the welfare state since Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and it is happening now. Just this week, significant news: the health industry said we will waive our blockage on patients with pre-existing conditions. We'll accept everybody, insurance companies, if you require everyone to be insured. Well, of course, that's the logic of health care reform. You have to have everybody insured, have to have those premiums coming in order for insurance companies to take the risk to insure everybody. That's a major change. That group and the small business group, which has also signed on with this, were against Clinton Care, killed it in 1993-94.
So you see a Tom Daschle as a get-it-done guy.
The point is, this is progressivism right here. I mean, we're about to see, you know, the new Social Security being born, and it's happening right in front of us. So I don't see this conservative tilt maybe in personnel, but here's what's happening in policy.
Let's go to Mark in Hartford, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Nice talking with y'all.
Sure.
I have to concur with you on the need for Obama to balance his cabinet. I'm not as disappointed as a lot of the core constituency are, because I think he's got to provide himself with some political cover. This whole campaign harps so much on the experience question. I think in order to really solidify his political capital, President-elect Obama has got to surround himself with a good composition of experienced people and novel thinkers. Now, he's got a lot of positions left to fill. I'm still hoping to see some novel thinkers come in there, but I find it actually a heartening thing that he's got a core of experienced people around him.
Well, okay, so there's a vote for where it's going so far. Mark in Hartford, thanks for your call. Let's go to Canton, New York, and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree that we really do need to see some novel speakers or novel thinkers in this cabinet. And even though I still have a lot of hope that Obama is going to accomplish some of the change that he promises, I do feel that a lot of the people he seems to be picking are sort of represent a status quo. And it would be nice to see some fresh names, even if, you know, people may not know much about them, they may not have a lot of experience, but we need new, fresh, brilliant people in the cabinet. And it just also amazes me that a crisis like that which is happening in America and around the world is what it takes for people to be finally ready for change, and just how inflexible the system has been. And it's time for people to understand that they're going to have to make sacrifices,
Elizabeth, I think we've got it. You're looking for those sort of out-of-the-box cabinet members as well. Joe Williams says, well, he's going for experience. He's got a lot of work to do first, but he's also fairly politically savvy. I can't believe that before this cabinet naming is done, we don't have maybe some names that will strike the public as sharply novel, if that's the right word. Here he was again, Barack Obama on 60 Minutes. Here he was getting at the kind of team of rivals theme that had begun to emerge in his cabinet naming.
I've been spending a lot of time reading Lincoln. There's a wisdom there and a humility about his approach to government, even before he was president, that I just find very helpful.
Put a lot of his political enemies in his cabinet.
He did.
Is that something you're considering?
Well, I tell you what, I find him a very wise man.
Barack Obama tipping the tall stovepipe hat maybe to Abraham Lincoln. Joe Williams, where does the Hillary Clinton nomination stand expected or rumored naming to Secretary of State stand as we end this week?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, upon further review, I'd have to say that I do agree with what Jack was saying in that there probably will be some novel picks coming down the road. The Hillary Clinton thing puzzles me as a journalist, because I think that she does have the necessary skills. I mean, there's been no shortage of people saying that.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, does the team of rivals approach really work in this instance? Because she is such a big personality and a big political force, and her husband comes along with it. It could be seen on two tiers. The first is that he is getting two for one, and that an influential person with an influential spouse who can help open some doors. And if she executes his policy and commits to adhering to his policy, there should be smooth sailing. The other question is, and I spoke with a couple of historians about this the other day, that if he is hiring her and she does not meet his expectations, or she does, for lack of a better term, go rogue, which is hard to see, but if she does not meet his expectations, how difficult would it be for him to, A, have her adjust, or B, get rid of her if the case came to that? And the consensus was that it would be very, very difficult, because there are a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters who are still out there who are agitating. There's emails going around, support Hillary, send your emails to the transition team saying that we want her as the Secretary of State. A lot of Clintonites who feel still kind of smarting from the wounds over the summer, who want to see their girl get a good position and get the hookup, so to speak, from the president-elect.
The position of Secretary of State, Madam Secretary, she would be. Of course, someone was quoting the other day on the show, be careful about hiring someone you can't fire, and you're pointing to the dynamic that could be right there with that, but it seems like it's still on track as far as I can tell. What do I know, Jack?
Yeah, if I may, Chris Matthews this morning had a good quip. He said, look, Obama is hiring, he wants to hire Clinton as Secretary of State, and he's forgiving Joe Lieberman. That proves he's a real Christian after all.
Okay, he's big. Diane Brady, Joe Williams, Jack, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a tool bag, floats into space, vampires at the cinema, and late-night jokes on Hillary Clinton, inevitably, this week. American astronaut Heidi Marie Stephenson Piper takes a spacewalk and loses a tool bag in space.
Oh, great. We have a lost tool. Your crew outside was not transferred, and it's loose.
Oh, great. My tool bag is loose, and off it went into the cosmos. Vampires in high school and teenage girls aflame as the big movie Twilight opens today.
You know what you are. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Say it. And Jay Leno on Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State.
This works out great for the Clintons. While Hillary is concentrating on foreign affairs, Bill can go back to concentrating on domestic affairs.
No, boy, you knew that was coming. Diane Brady is with us from Business Week magazine, Joe Williams from the Boston Globe, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Jim in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment. You know, negativity is contagious. If I go into work in the morning in a great mood and my boss is in a terrible mood, it affects everybody at the office.
Yeah.
I just think this would be a perfect time right before Thanksgiving for Obama to come out and say, you know, things are going to be okay and we're going to get through this, just to calm the nerves of everybody. I mean, I received a card some time back from someone that inside said, you know, worrying, you know, takes away today's, you know, takes away your strength but doesn't solve any of your problems. You know what I mean? So
yep.
I think if we all stopped, you know, worrying, or at least, you know, we had somebody out there, especially someone like Obama, that everybody now is looking up to come out and, you know, just kind of ease everybody and let everybody know that we're going to get through this. I mean, I can't even turn on the news anymore without getting, you know, nervous about everything that's stock market.
Jim, I know exactly what you mean, and I'm part of the news, and I'm glad you said all that. I mean, we're quoting John Lewis here today and Dan Shore. They both say be optimistic, and I'm sure others would as well. But Jack, there's this question of the right balance. I mean, on the one hand, we've got big, enormous, very real problems that a smart, mature country needs to step up and deal with. On the other hand, Jim's exactly right. I really felt it in this last week. I mean, you can get yourself into a country can get into a kind of downward spiral of woe is me.
Yes, it can. And that's, of course, John Maynard Keynes's famous formula, animal spirits, that animal spirits account for the rise in markets and eupeptic consumers, and animal spirits, when they deflate, go in the other direction. And, you know, I think a president-elect has to be very careful. I take his point, though. I mean, it's almost as if Obama needs to go back into history and say, look, compare this moment to that moment, say, 1932, 1933. We have so much more going for us than America did then. And one of the things we have going for us is that a Great Depression happened. And we learned that the only way a government gets out of a depression is by massive stimulation of the economy. Ergo, World War II. We can't do World War II, but by gosh, we have learned the lessons of Keynesian economics. And we are going to spend spend until this machine starts to rise. We're going to give money to the states to spend. We're going to give money to construction projects. We're going to increase unemployment. We're going to train people. And we're going to push this mighty engine forward. And folks, it worked then and it'll work now.
Well, so you say, Jack, but there may be some who's we kemosabe going on here. I mean, it's not happening right now. Diane Brady, I have to say, I think the whole country believed exactly what Jack has just articulated. We learned from the Great Depression that would never happen again. And yet in this last week, and I'm sorry to Jim in Providence, who once just upbeat, but there were moments in the last week or two when it's felt like, did we really learn? Do we really know what we're doing? Do we know how to address this?
I don't know if every, you know, it's like every, dysfunctional family is unhappy in its own way. Mm. I think that you don't even have to go back to the Depression. Go back to 1980 and look at the unemployment figures coming out of the 70s, much worse off than we are today. So I think that, yes, we have to face reality. There's a lot of pain, but there is a lot going on in this economy. I think the stimulus, the recognition that there has to be massive intervention, not just in this country, but around the world. Let's not forget this is a global crisis, and that's part of what's going on here. But it's difficult to learn lessons. The U.S. was not as much a global economy back in the 30s. What happens in China, what happens in Britain is very important to our health, who holds our debt at this point. But, you know, one bright spot, I think, is look at the people coming into the U.S. We were the epicenter of this crisis, and yet everybody now, what do they want? U.S. Treasuries. So there's a faith in the integrity of this country and the flexibility of this economy that people think we're going to get through to the other side.
Let's go to Bobby in Columbia, South Carolina. Bobby, you're on the air.
Yes, my concern is that I hope that our country, the folks of our country, give President-elect Obama a chance to do the things that he said that he would like to do for our country and for our progress. We also have to remember that we are still being led by President Bush and his administration. We have 2 months of time for him to continue to do what he needs to do to make sure that we get out of some of the things that we are in right now and not try to cast everything on to President-elect Obama. And then once he gets into office, realize that during the Clinton years, when former President Clinton took office, he came into the office when things were really bad also. And now they're somewhat worse. So hopefully we will give President-elect Obama the chance to actually do the things and make the corrections that need to be made so that we can get back on track and be a prosperous.
Bobby, we hear you loud and clear. What do you say, Joe?
Well, that's exactly the point that ran through my mind when we were talking about a lot of this stuff, is that we still have a president who's in office right now. And a lot of people were so optimistic and so high on Obama's election that they want him to take control right now. But he's not. He doesn't have that authority. And we don't really have a whole lot of leadership, or at least images of leadership, coming out of the White House on this. I mean, where is President Bush saying things will be okay? Calm down, everyone. We're working on it. We're working as hard as we can. This transition will be smooth. We don't see a lot of that in recent days.
Why do you think that is? I don't want to get into, as President Bush would say, pop psychology. But has he checked out already? What's the sense in Washington? Is George W. Bush? He seems kind of MIA. He comes out and makes statements, but where's his head at?
The sense is definitely that he's MIA, but also that he may be busy trying to shore up his legacy or trying to get a lot of these undercover rules passed. Then that probably is taking a precedent, because the impression that you hear around town is that he is waiting for the next administration. He doesn't, the charitable view is that he doesn't want to step on President Obama's transition. The uncharitable view is that he's gone. He's out of here. It's not his problem anymore. Can I stop being president now?
Yeah. I was just going to say, and he is being president. And you mentioned those rules, Joe. I mean, there are scores of these last night, midnight rule changes. He's rolling back regulatory protections for furry creatures and fish and chemical workers and women needing contraceptives and consumers hired by defective products. All of this, of course, to the delight of polluters, makers of shoddy goods, sweatshop operators, and ransackers of the public land. You know, he began his administration by scrapping his campaign 2000 promise to regulate CO2 emissions, and he ends it with F ratings from the environmental pressure groups, F for failure, which really is the first and last word on the presidency of George W. Bush.
Well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the presidency? Diane, you're at Business Week magazine.
And I'm Canadian, so I can't vote. So that puts me in a neutral position.
What, polluters and ransackers feasting on the last midnight regulations of George W. Bush? Is there really such a big push on to get it changed right now?
I think so. But, there's also the opportunity to change things back. And one of the biggest, I think, appointments that Obama is going to make is the energy secretary. I don't know how many listeners out there can actually name the existing one, but it's not been a high-profile position. And in the 21st
I would say
century,
Dick Cheney, though I know that's not
like. Given where the world's moving, even the focus on green business getting us out of this, that's going to be a very, very important position, and it should be a high-profile one.
Any names floating out there on that? Joe, Diane, do we know? Energy?
Well, Bill Richardson had been mentioned a time or two in some reports that I've heard.
Governor, yeah.
Al Gore's wearing better ties these days.
There's a span. Eddie's calling from Boston. Eddie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring up the fact that I see a lot of people saying give Obama a chance and, maybe he'll have some mistakes.
at the same time, I hope, especially the Obama supporters, they aren't, you know, glazed and think that if Obama fails, oh, no one could have done anything successful. I think we have to be objective and realize that he's not, you know, he will make mistakes, but that doesn't mean no one could have succeeded.
Yes, I hear your skepticism. You don't want to be fully on the bandwagon. Let's hold him to a real and tough standard. At the same time, in a time like this, when the country has done something quite extraordinary, I think whatever party you're in, I suppose the country deserves to take a little breath and say, okay, maybe there is a new start here. Otherwise, how do you get your animal spirits out of the ditch? But Eddie, thanks for calling. We, of course, we got some brickbats thrown at Obama from abroad this week. The second in command of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, a video on Thursday came out attacking President-elect Barack Obama, calling him a new face on a country with a, quote, heart full of hate. Also called Obama literally a house slave, translated in the subtitles there on the Al-Qaeda video as House Negro, a term that Malcolm X and others used to dismiss black leaders who wouldn't stand up to whites. Let's listen to some of that Arabic from Zawahiri, and I'll give you a little English over it here.
وَإِن كُنْتَ لَازِلْتَ تُكَابِرُ فِي فَشَلِ أَمْرِيكَ فِي أَفْغَانِسْتَانِ فَتَذَكَّرْ مَصِيرَ بُوشْ وَبَرْوِيزْ مُشَرَّفْ.
Is the Al-Qaeda number two saying, if you still want to be stubborn about America's failure in Afghanistan, then remember the fate of Bush and Musharraf and the fate of the Soviets and the British before them. You represent the direct opposite of honorable black Americans, like Malik al-Shabazz or Malcolm X, may Allah have mercy on him, he said. And in you and in Colin Powell, Rice and your likes, the words of Malcolm X, may Allah have mercy on him, he said again, concerning House Negroes are confirmed. There's Al-Qaeda's number two. Joe Williams, how does that hit your ear? Terrorist leader from afar by video on the web throwing the House Slave, House Negro tag at Barack Obama.
Well, it's kind of curious and a little head-scratching given the fact that reports have that Al-Qaeda has its own racial problems as well, but my biggest question is, well, why does race enter into this for them other than a convenient way to make a broad-based attack that a lot of people would understand, number one? And number two, why are we listening to him about President Obama? I mean, certainly he has a lot to say, and I think it's a matter of Al-Qaeda trying to maintain its relevance and doing so in a way that will turn off probably 80% of the people who hear it and not do anything other than energize his hardcore supporters, which, you know, one could argue that he didn't really necessarily need to go there to do that. I think a lot of support for Barack Obama internationally is coming from the Muslim world. They're just as likely to turn this off, and it's just as likely to strike them as a brick upside the ear as it would most Americans and most African Americans. So it's really kind of curious to me as to why he went there, but you know,
I don't think it's curious at all, actually. I think that it's like the Osama bin Laden holiday messages. I mean, their fight is to get onto the radar screen, and what better way than to say inflammatory stuff? It's very provocative. That's kind of their stock and trade, and they're losing one of their best mobilizing forces. Love him or hate him, George Bush has been they could personify him as America in a way that they found very mobilizing. Obama, less so. They're trying to rally the troops. So I didn't find it surprising at all.
Sounded pretty desperate to me, Jack. I mean, this is a hard guy to criticize in that world, even in the Islamic world. Barack Obama, or maybe even especially, there's been a lot of reports of popular enthusiasm for this president-elect.
Yes, and I think that Al-Qaeda has to see the handwriting on the wall, that simply the election of Obama and then his face everywhere is doing more for against them and more for the idea that America isn't involved in some war of civilizations against Muslims. It's doing more for that than anything possible. This is armies. This is billions. This is, you know, this is public diplomacy at the highest level. And meanwhile, here at home, you know, American Muslims, over 90% of them voted, and 89% of them voted for this House slave. So the House is the White House, and it's the biggest job in the world.
Sad and strange moment at the Federalist Society dinner in Thursday in Washington. Last night, U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey began slurring his words. Let's listen. And collapsed.
and that the country is safer as a result.
Sorry, from Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General, he was there justifying or speaking to Bush administration steps on the security front and how the law has been used in that regard. But Joe Williams there, talk about a dramatic moment. He just went down at the podium, Joe.
Yes, it's very, very frightening, especially given some of the things that have happened recently with Congressman Tim Johnson from South Carolina, or from South Dakota, beg your pardon, and Ted Kennedy, both of whom had very, very serious health problems. And it just sort of is a shocking reminder that there is a lot of pressure and a lot of stress that the high-profile people are under. And, you know, things like this could happen at any time.
Of course, maybe especially when you're trying to secure a legacy that's going to be a little bit tricky to secure on that front. Guantanamo ruling this week, we may see some of those folks out of there soon, Jack, says a big judge.
Yes, a Bush 43 appointed judge, conservative, and he wants these, and he says there was no evidence for these five men to have been kept 7 years in cages. I mean, it's when you start to read about the details, and one of the men was severely beaten. Another man is going blind in one eye because he was kept so long. So this is the sorriest of the Bush administration legacies right there.
Diane, we've got 10 seconds. When does the economic sun come up, Diane? Tell us.
Can I wait till 2010?
Okay, if you must, we'll try and hold on. Diane Brady, senior editor at Business Week magazine, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for looking
Thank
to
you.
The news of this week. Thanks, Diane. And Joe Williams, deputy Washington bureau chief with the Boston Globe. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, we soldier on.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Tom.
With a happy heart, as long as we can keep it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.